So life was pretty good on Greendale Station.
It sure was, because we were not only able to move about the station at our own leisure, like the old aunties and uncles used to come over when Dad was doing mulesing for the lambs, so there was a chance for them to come over and join in that, because we used to gather up the lamb tails and put them on a big fire, and we used to sit around and wait for them to cook, and then everybody would have a feed out of that. But also the old aunties used to come home. We used to go and collect bush food. Not all the time. Once or twice a year they come over, and we'd go out and collect a lot of goodies to eat, berries and gum, and maybe the occasional emu or kangaroo, whatever, you know, they got at the time.
And what was your favourite food?
My favourite was, I would say, the lamb's tails. Because once a year we were able to cook those up, and that meant a big, you know, all the brothers and sisters and some of the uncles and aunties would sit around, and the guitars would be going, they'd be singing and telling stories, and it was really, really great fun. Dad was a very good stockman, and he encouraged his children to do sport. So my older brothers and sisters, they played netball or basketball, and the boys played football for Ballarannel Club.
And what were their names, your brothers and sisters?
That was Alfie and Tommy, Joey, Maxie, Jeannie and Joni played basketball. Myself, I didn't play basketball at all. I just joined up with the marching girls when I was about 13 or something. I enjoyed going to competitions with the marching girls. The younger ones, they played hockey, and later on in their school years they played hockey, like Patsy and Maureen. And Danny, I think he went away early to Melbourne to live with my older sister, Joni, who got him into a job over there, and he got a trade in the boot trade. He was a boot maker. So, you know, from leaving Greendale, it wasn't as if we're getting sent away to nobody. We was getting sent away to families to either go further the education at school or to go and work in the cities. Myself, I went to my old auntie to go to high school over at Euston, and we went to Robinvale High School. That was good fun, because my two old aunties, one lived at Robinvale and one lived at Euston, went fishing every day. So we used to go down to the lock at Robinvale there in Euston and, you know, catch the biggest perch, and, you know, and because all the Italians had their, market gardens there, well, used to go buy boxes of tomatoes and, you know, all the fruits and vegetables that we wanted, because a lot of my people worked in those picking for them. They moved there in the 40s, a lot of them that lived over in Robinvale, and so they went picking there. We had an uncle that went off to Young, and he picked cherries up there, so he'd bring cherries back, and, you know. So it was good fun growing up in my family group. It was no rows, no fights, no drinking. So every day was just absolutely blissful, because we always had something to do, whether to gather wood for the fire and Mum would be cooking scones, or, you know, putting a leg of lamb in the oven, or whatever it was. And everybody enjoyed everyone's company. And I used to sit around and listen to the old people talking when they did come to visit. Like, Dad had old sisters that come, and Mum had old sisters. And at various times, and they they'd give the news around because some had come from up Lake Gallico way or down at I can't think of the town, Hilston, maybe Mildura here or wherever. So the family got other members of the family of my mother and my father's brothers and sisters. They always come to Ballarandle to visit. There was times when I was at Greenon when two old sisters used to come, and that was hilarious. Such beautiful people. But one old auntie, she used to like to dance around. You know, she could waltz and do all them kind of things. My dad, he went blind while he was on Greendale Station, and so he used to play the, you know, the piano accordion, and there'd be great sing songs and things with the piano accordion. My brother Max, who's passed now, he just make the guitar talk. So, you know, with the guitar and the accordion, it was, and singing along, it was just fantastic. The thing with when you're growing up, you don't realise that times are changing around you. And so by the time my dad was completely blind and they moved to a house in town, I hadn't realised it, but things changed because it meant that I had to go to school regular. It also meant that I had to mix in a community that didn't really recognise us as Aboriginal people in the community. And so it was hard walking in that front gate every morning to go to school and then back home. We couldn't, if we went to the pictures, we had to sit in a section where Aboriginal people sat. And I used to go to the matinees or go to the pictures again on the Saturday night with the older brothers and sisters. And they weren't allowed to go unless they took us younger ones. So, you know, everyone was looking out for everyone, somebody else. And it was like we all went together, we all come home together. And that was our motto, that if we went away somewhere, we all come home together. My brothers used to go away to the football, so the sisters went to play basketball, but they all come home together. So by that time there was a car, and then they were able to drive and things like that. So that was good for my mum and dad to have the older ones coming back, because he left the station and then he went on to a pension. And then it was hard for them because they never had that freedom of, you know, going to get a kangaroo, or not so much kangaroo but emu, or, you know, a goat maybe, or rabbits. So
they missed that life, that fun of being out in the farm.
But the good thing about that, the work ethic with my dad, my brothers were able to get jobs on other stations like Stockman, and I think Maxie went on to Yanga to do gardening, and Joey used to do stock work. But then when he got married, he took his family away to Melbourne, and then he worked at the repatriation place down in Melbourne, the hospital, and he took care of the gardens there for years until he retired. So all these years with my brothers and sisters, and I'm the one that's like up and down, because I had all these little kiddies then, married and had all these little kiddies.
So where were you in the number of 11 kids? What number were you?
I'm number 7.
So you were a little bit more than halfway. So you had the older ones to guide you, and you were kind of mothered the younger ones.
Yeah. Yeah, they were like mothers to me, my sisters. They looked after me. They wiped my nose, something terrible when it had to be done if I cried to go with them. But the mother and the father, my mother and father, were fantastic. When she went to town, to live in town, she walked everywhere, like to do shopping and things like that. Set us off to school, went and done her chores, and then, you know, back home again, but always... But either one of the grandfathers were there, either my father's father or my mother's father. At times she had the two old grandfathers. One was bedridden and one was blind.
And how did your father go blind on the station?
He got hit in the eye by a grasshopper or something, and he just went like that and forgot about it. But his boss, Mr. Grabo, sent him away to Melbourne to have the operation. Flew him down an aeroplane, mind you, back in, must have been late 50s. And when he come home, he had this patch on his arm. We were all waiting. He had this glass eye. But what they'd done, early days for surgeons, they cut the nerve to this eye too and sent him blind that way. So, but he never complained. He had the most beautiful voice, my dad. He could sing him. Right up until he died, he was like he was... You'd swear that he was a 50-year-old man with the way that, you know, he kept himself with his strong body and...
And so
beautiful ways.
When you were on Greendale, how far were you in from town?
6 miles.
6 miles.
But that was Orson Cart, you see. We had to go to school by Orson Cart.
Did you?
Yeah, Mum used to take us in an old spring cart. Sometimes when she couldn't bring us to school, she sent my brother Maxie in to, you know, to drive the cart in. But if Maxie wanted to wag, so did we. Because he couldn't send us, he couldn't say, go on, you kids go to school, because we'd tell on him. So we all had to wag. If he wanted to wag, we all wagged.
And what did you do when you wagged?
We went pick it up dead wool and sold it, and supposedly to buy lollies. So we brought lollies, but he kept most of the money for his pictures and things like that. And I think he was buying tobacco too, because he used to smoke, that little fella. And he would act the goat, you know, he'd go and talk to anybody, any old swaggies along the road, he'd pick them up and bring them home to Greendale, put them in the shed for 2 or 3 days, feed them up, and, you know. The old swaggies used to come quite regular because it's been on the main highway and everybody was out of work, and so they'd walk with the swag on the back. Well, nobody got past our gate, did they? Not with Maxie. Not with Maxie around. He'd bring them down and, you know, you'd have mum would give them, feed them, yeah. And
during the Depression, was it?
Well, this is in the 50s, or, yeah, so you know, late 50s. So he must have been... I think people were just going anywhere for work, wherever they could at the time.
And you said that your old people, the grandparents, came from the mission. What was the mission?
No, they never come from the mission.
Who came, where did your old grandparents come from when they came across from to Greendale?
Dad's father was a drover, and he worked up around Hillston, Cobar. He was an Iper man, so he worked all around all his life until he got bedridden, that old fella. But he also worked at Weldera Station.
Where was that?
That's just 10 or 11 k, or 20 k's out of Ballaran on the Euston Road. And I think that's where the grandparents, where Mum and Dad might have met when both grandfathers were out there. Because
right.
They lived there for a while in camps and worked right. On that big station there too.
And were your mum's family Nyampa as well?
No, they Muddy people.
Muddy.
Yeah.
So your grandparents on both sides were Muddy?
No. One of my grandfather that I'm talking about, the old blind fella, he's a Nunungerry man. He's from the Flinders Ranges.
Oh, wow.
He had a wife and daughters. When he come over to the Murray River and went along, like up to Colkine and then on to Balcony, and met my grandmother over on probably at Paker Station, because that's where they lived there. The Kirby family lived on Paker Station. So Jeremiah used to do all the fencing and that there. And I think he might have been a He might have been one of them policeman fellas too, you know, hunting down other people.
Trackers.
I don't know. I don't know much about old Jeremiah, my old great-grandfather. That's my grandmother's father. So I don't know much about him. That Grandfather Kelly, his mother was an Iampa woman, but he did work all around the station because he had a white father, you see. And I think he might have read, my dad might have been born over at Moonakulla Mission, actually. And when they were growing up, and the oldest girls in the family, the ones that Grandfather Kelly had, the two girls, not my grandmother's daughters, but he had a wife too, when they were ready to go into service, the government was eyeing them off, so he dumped the Ballarat and went up there.
Took them away.
Yeah, because they usually got word that there was going to be, you know, the government was looking for young women to go and do service in Sydney. Well, he wasn't going to let his daughters do that, so he brought them over there and married them off.
And how did your mum and dad meet, did you say?
Well, they would have met in the early days in Ballarat as teenagers.
Yeah.
I don't know, but they got married at Euston. So the families must have been, you know, mum's family had a big wagon and things like that. They used to move around a lot too.
And what was her surname before she got married?
She was a Pierce. So Barry Pierce is her nephew.
Right.
That's Uncle Tom's son. Uncle Tom and his wife settled at Robinvale. Auntie Jean Sampson and her husband settled at Robinvale as well, and Auntie Myrtle with her husband, Uncle Stuart Clayton, they settled at Euston. So they had goes to looking after the old fella. They used to take in turns looking after the old, and the same with Dad's sisters. They had turns looking after their father. So it was Mum and Dad's turn to have them sometimes in the 60s. So Mum looked after them as well as looked after all us kids. She read to three grandkids as well.
Your mum?
Yeah, so, you know, she was solid though. She was solid. She wouldn't say no to any kid really. Especially her grandkids. She was a very caring person.
And she started trying to get Mungo Radio.
That was back in the early 60s too, when that old girl, when she read about it in a newspaper, that Mungo Lady was discovered. And, of course, Mungo Man come a few years later, so
at Mungo National
she was
Park.
Right on the ball, so she wrote to the National Park or wrote to those scientific people and asked them what the hell they were doing. But she was more wanting to know how could they do them things without asking. But if you look back at the time, they didn't have to ask. You know, it was the principle of them doing these things that upset her greatly. And
and was your dad alive at the time?
Dad was alive at the time. He was, because he was there, he was never outspoken to such things, but he always agreed. If she wanted to do something about things, he followed her footsteps and said, yeah, well, you know, I support you in that, but he never ever did his own thing in talking. He talked quietly amongst his own mobs or, you know, the men around the town and that, but he never stopped her from...
He was supportive.
yeah, very supportive to what she was doing.
And do you remember her, you know, writing to them?
Of course. She had this way of telling you that you, you got to go, or we got to go, or we got to do this, or we got to do that. Come with me, or whatever. So you just say, I can't go, or, you know, we're not going. I mean, many a time, me and my husband, with our little kiddies, drove her to various meetings, or supported her. Like, we'd take Mum and Dad anywhere they wanted to go, whether it be going up to see the old auntie over in Shepparton, or going way up to Lake Angelico to, you know, to see the mobs out there. Not very often, but Dad only had one brother, and it broke his heart when he died early. I mean, I must have been, I don't know, I would have only had the one boy, Darryl, I suppose, when Uncle Tom died. So wherever Mum and Dad needed to be, whether it be Melbourne, to the sisters down there, they either come and pick them up, or we took them down for various functions or whatever. But she never let go of her Aboriginality and her culture. So she was always very outspoken about her culture and the preservation of the culture on the ground.
And she worked with other Aboriginal women.
Yeah.
Who did she work with in trying to get Mungo Ladies' remains back to Mungo National?
Well, when she was at the on the board or the committee at the in the early days with the advisory committee to Mungo National Park, she had Auntie Renee Mitchell, Auntie Elsie Jones, Auntie Tibby Breyer, and Auntie Alice Bugmy. So those old ladies, along with my mother, were on that advisory committee. But she was very outspoken on that advisory committee because...
So that was they in the 1970s.
Yeah, they said, you know, you do this, Ellie, or you do it because you talk better. You know, so she wasn't frightened to say.
She was very persuasive.
Yeah, she wasn't frightened to say. So they, very strong women, but they did need that spokesman to mouth those words to the full table.
And your mum was the
and
one.
And my
to do
mother
that.
Was that person, because she never hesitated to let them know about, you know, what was...
what she thought.
Well, she didn't try to be nasty about things, but she let them know in a friendly kind of way that, you know, it would be better to do this or better to do that, I should think, because...
And did she have
She
anyone?
Wasn't narky to anybody, my mother. She was very, very kind to all walks of life and all people, so...
And did she have any archaeologists or scientists who actually were quite helpful towards the cause?
Oh, Dr. Isabel McBride became a good friend to Mum and very supportive at her meetings because she was another woman at the meeting. Sharon Sullivan, I think, who might have been head of the National Parks and Wildlife Service at the time, she was fantastic. She listened to what Mum said. And, of course, she said it went with me. I'll think of her name in a minute. Oh, fancy forgetting about her.
So they were very helpful, and did they encourage your mum to keep going?
Because she's had all the Western region, Aboriginal people in the Western region supporting and what was happening. I mean, you know, we had the Western region, we had like William Bates, and we had all those Barkindji people from way out, along from Wilcannia right down to Broken Hill right through. So the Western region was a big supportive group for the Land Rights Act. And so it sort of came channeling out through that, like Badger Bates was excellent because he was that Aboriginal person working in the service.
National parks.
In the national parks, yeah. And we had Ray Kelly and Glenn... came down from the Hunter region. They were Aboriginal people in the national park. You know, a big support group, but also Mum had a big support group or knowledge group that she did. She did the Catholic Diocese of Forbes and Parks, which was our diocese, plus right across to Sydney. She had this big support group from the family education mob, and
which was known as... So she was really good at garnering support from a lot of different people.
She went to a lot of gatherings or supportive mechanisms to voice her opinion about not only education but schools and culture and a whole range of things over the years that you can't help but get caught up in it. And so when she got old and weary, she pushed me into positions, you know. I mean, I ended up on the board, mind you, the school board or something in Ballarat for the Catholic school. You know, little things like that, that... she thought that if you didn't get in there and say what you wanted to say, education-wise, for your family group, well, you'll never get heard. And so she wasn't pushy, though. It's just automatically said, oh, well, you go to this one or you go there or I think you should, you know.
And so you felt like you wanted to do it rather than being pushed into it.
Yeah, because the talk is about culture, education, culture and education and... jobs and work and school is constantly talking about those things.
So when Mungo Man was finally brought back...
But see, she Mungo Lady came before him and she
and
was...
And she was alive when Mungo
She was
Lady
alive
came.
When that happened, and so were those other old ladies. So those women, to me, were the greatest ones that you could... for since white man come in, they were the greatest because they sat there and they did their job in explaining to the wider communities just what needed to be done. So all national parks run with those kind of things then, otherwise they would have just went sailing along, not even realising what they were doing and what they was in around towns and where Aboriginal people were without even consulting. So for them women to be there, those brave women to be there and talking and bringing them into what needed to be done at that level spread right through, I believe anyways, because then we get to the stage where the scientific people are listening and taking into account what they were doing and to very confronting to them when Aboriginal people ask them questions. So they she brought them in so that it was more on friendly, you know, she regarded them as her friends.
So it wasn't a confrontational.
No. And even the people that worked in the department were her friends.
And like, and I interviewed your sister, Maureen, and she said that you often, if you went to Melbourne, would go and see Jim Bowler.
Who yes, she the, did. Yep.
The geomorphologist that discovered
yes.
Mungo Lady.
Yes,
Mungo
she used
Man.
To go and see him. And when she went to Canberra, she actually went. We actually went and stayed with Ellen Thorne. You know, so...
So she worked with people.
She worked with people, and so that gave me the opportunity to work with people too, because when Steve Webb came into it, I went and stayed with Steve and his wife, and, you know, Not as if I'm trying to tell them anything or they're trying to tell me anything. It's just that it's better to be friends and to talk rather than be, nasty to one another, because it's not our style and it's not our nature to be like that.
And can you remember that day when Mungo Lady was brought home and all those old ladies were there and your mum? What were the sorts of things they were saying on that day? That must have been a big day for them. That was in 1992?
Yes, and those old women, when they spoke together, they whispered. They didn't brag, they whispered to one another and they talked quietly to one another. So I don't know what was said.
What would your mum have said to you?
Even though I'm standing there and I've got children of my own there, it was one of the greatest things to see them making that happen. It was like I was so proud to be standing there and witness that, but also to be proud of those, not only my mother, but those women that were there and that on them seats. They were the most, I put them on a very high level. I don't think I'll ever see that again in my lifetime of women sitting together, whispering and talking the way they did to one another. Now they just clicked, and it meant that, bringing our old people home. Because remember, my people are very, very spiritual. And for that to happen, it was like a second home coming for them, to bring them back onto country.
And how would they have felt, do you think, in November last year when Mungo Man was brought back home?
Well, they would have been absolutely elated with that, because of course they witnessed it all, along with our other spiritual people that are from around the lakes. They would have been all there. We felt them there. So
how did you feel on that day?
Well, I knew my people were standing beside me. I knew Marty, my mum was there. You know, my dad, my old people, all the old people standing there, seeing that very important person come home. It was like a big achievement for Aboriginal people as well to witness that. It gives them something to carry on now for their recognition and also for their culture, because that is what culture is. It's not only looking after our people that are passed on, but looking after our people that are still here today. And know one day we're all going to be gone, but we know that we're all going to be together. And this is what makes you proud, because you know you've achieved something in this life that they've witnessed in their afterlife. You know, it's just beautiful. It's just fantastic, because the way that Mungo Lady and Mungo Man did it, they went one at a time, it was her first. And that white Australia thought that would be the end of it. Oh no, she can't be that old, blah, blah.
And originally then, they thought she's only 20,000, and then it turns out Mungo Lady and Mungo Man over 40,000.
Yes, but then it was like, they didn't, if they believed it, they didn't want to acknowledge it. And lo and behold, Mungo Man comes up and he takes it a bit further. It's like, right, they're not listening to Aboriginal people, so I'll go this time, if you know what I mean. I know how my old people work.
Yes.
And there he comes. And then things are quiet for a while, and then up comes the footprints, So
and tell us about that.
It's a long...
Your daughter discovered the footprints.
Yeah, but the thing is with the footprints, it's not the end of it.
Can you just explain to people listening who don't know about the footprints? Can you tell me about that discovery?
I can't understand why people don't know about the footprints, because it was very widely spread out throughout the world with the media, and of course there's books on it and everything else now. But my daughter, little Mary, she actually found those footprints on the day when we were out doing a culture survey out in the back of that country there with Dr. Steve Webb.
Mungo National Park.
Yeah, Mungo National Park. So, you know, it was meant to be.
So she discovered one of these footprints. But
only the one, but when we look closely, there's many. Now there's thousands. You know, it's like I want to be noticed too, like the footprints are coming up.
About thousands of years old.
Yeah, over 19,000 or 20,000 year old.
That must have been very exciting.
The thing with dating with our Aboriginal people, though, I think any number is good enough for white Australia to take on board, but it's probably don't want to give us too much recognition. Don't want to give us too much recognition because there's a people and its culture that's lived on this landscape for 60,000 years. And when you look at it, they should be ashamed of themselves, because 60,000 years of living and walking in an environment and looking after it, it's gone. The whole environment's gone. It's absolutely changed. For the last 250 years, what have people done to this landscape? You know, I go back to my Greendale days when I took for granted that landscape. Gradually it's getting chewed away. And where's all my resources gone in that short time? And when I look, I can't walk where with my little great granddaughter, 50 years after I walked on that landscape, I can't walk with her and show her the things that I was shown, because they've wrecked the place. And that's all over Australia. I mean, how many other Aboriginal people got their places wrecked?
And can we just go on to your grandchildren? Can you tell me about your husband, how your grandchildren came about to be? How did you meet your partner, your husband?
The family groups, like I said, they knew one another. The old grandfathers knew one another. Yeah. They had a bond there, a connection, probably through an old Aboriginal woman there, I don't know. But the thing is, they were seasonals. They worked in the same areas where my old people worked, either at Mildura or Robinvale or wherever. They did probably wood cutting and charcoal burning, and they probably did the pumps and, you know, odd jobs around the grapevines or paddocks or whatever, fencing or whatever, I don't know. But I know that my grandfather and Joe's grandfather were very, very close. More like they had this connection. Joe's mother had a connection with my grandfather too, because she used to come, after we left Greendale, she used to come to town and actually pick up my grandfather and take him out to Greendale again, where they lived then, and take him for a few days out there and keep him there. But she was a good friend to my mother, so...
They were great family friends.
They were family friends, and they were virtually like us. They didn't have much, but our fathers worked. If you know what I mean, always worked.
And did you fall in love with Joe?
Well, what do you do when you get married and have children? Of course you do.
And tell us about your children.
They are the greatest things I've ever seen, my kids.
Can you tell me their names?
Well, Darryl was the apple of everybody's eye at the time when he was born. And I had the sisters in Melbourne living, so I was able to, he was born in Melbourne. So me and Joe got married in Melbourne, and he was, we had him down there for a few weeks in Melbourne with the sister. So he was this new little baby in the, you know, in the family.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting, even though I had older nieces and nephews. So, and then Jason, he was born at Robinvale. No, he was born at Ballarannel. And he had the hare lip and cleft palate. So we kind of stuck in Ballarannel then, because we have to give back and forth to the Royal Children's for his first 6 months of his life before he had his operation. I had to go every, either me or Joe had to go with Jason and take him to the Royal Children's Hospital. So that was a constant thing, and the support of the family down there was one of the greatest things. We always had somewhere to stay. So our base was Ballarat. We either live with my mum and dad, or we live with one of the brothers that still lived in Ballarat. You know, there was always somewhere.
Family.
Yeah. So.
And the next one, the next child?
Gary, Joe was working out at Bagura Station, which is up that Mungo Road. He was a baby up there, and we had Jason and Darryl up there. So we were there for a while, and then over 2 mil from there, I think we might have went to Ballarannel and rented a little house there to send Darryl to school. Because it's Darryl 4 years before Jason. Before Jason, and Jason and Gary are just a year apart. So when it was time for Darryl to go to school, we rented a little house in Ballarannel and sent him to school there. But he had his cousins, like Jeannie, my sister, her children were going to St. Joseph's.
And what work were you doing?
What work was I doing? Oh, I never actually did any work. I helped my mum and theirs and my older sister. We helped one another then with the rest of the family, and either washing or cooking or whatever for, you know, the sister, I had a sister there and a brother over there who drank quite a lot. So, you know, we'd do the rounds, and my older sister Jeannie, she would wash dishes and cook meals and then come up to help me, and then we'd go up to Mum's and help Mum with
her. What work did Joe do?
Joe did odd jobs. He went out on stations and did day's work, or He went droving for a while, because he was a drover too. He went with old Jack Winch, he was a driver. That's Patsy's husband, his grandfather. Joe went working with him. So, you know, over the years, it's been full family support with the brothers and sisters and sharing.
And the kids were up to, so there was...
Gary
and Jeannie. Was Jeannie next?
Bernadette. There's no Jeannie.
Bernadette, yep.
Yeah, she was... We'd moved from one house to another when she was born. Got a three-bedroom house. The other one was a two-bedroom house. So we lived there for a while, and then... Bernadette mainly went down to... my sister Joycey used to scream to go with her. So she used to take her in bits and pieces, went before she started school. And then Verna was born, and then she went with Jeannie. She used to always cry to follow Jeannie. So Jeannie had her big family, took that back and forth. They come for holidays or come see Mum and Dad, the kids would jump in and go with them. But they weren't going to school, so it was okay for them to...
Get away with it.
Yeah, the older cousins would help look after them and things like that. And Douglas and Mary, we finally got a housing commission house, mind you, in Ballarannel. And they marched off to school from there with the rest of the family.
And... your involvement with, you've followed in your mum's footsteps in getting Mungo Man back. You're really, really still very much involved, and you're on the Andrew Lakes Regional World Heritage
Advisory
Aboriginal Advisory Group. And does it take up a lot of your time?
It takes up a lot of, it doesn't take up any time, because it's a pleasure to be involved in a preservation and preserving of our cultural heritage. It's a pleasure too to be with other Aboriginal tribes, because even though we might not agree on some things, we are all the same people, and we thrive to make things work for that protection and for that preservation of that cultural heritage that's on the ground. It doesn't matter who owns what, it's more to protect it, so that 100 years down the track it's still going to be there on the ground, not chewed up. Like I've seen growing up, the changes in the landscape, I'd hate to see the change in the landscape where our cultural heritage is concerned, when it's on such a high standard of world heritage. It is vital. It is vital for all mankind to make sure that is preserved, so that people can learn from it.
And there, what do you think,
a lot more
can
to learn? I mean, we've had the footprints now. That's like 11 or 12 years ago, maybe more. Something else is going to happen. And, of course, it's going to happen at the National Park or in the World Heritage Area. To just make people realise a bit more that this is precious, what we have. And we all have to thrive and look after that precious thing that we have on the ground out there for future generations. It's no different from having a riverway that we must protect, that water, because that's vital for our, that's our lifeline for all mankind, that water. So rivers, lakes and vegetation is vital for survival in a landscape, and that's what we thrive to protect. And whether that would be in a national park or making people aware out there that don't get themselves involved in such things, somebody's got to speak for them too, because they are silent. They are the silent people out there that don't know that you can go 50 or 60 years without realising that when you turn around that it's all gone. So I thrive to make people aware, because it's so vital. If my people could have done that for 60,000 years on this landscape, I can't see why we can't survive another 60,000 years if we care and manage and not be spiteful towards one another, but sharing the business of looking after things would be one of the greatest things or treasures that I could leave. If I can just tell somebody that's going to think like that for the next 50 years, I'm going to try my hardest to make people aware, you know.
And the Mungo Man has been brought back to Mungo National Park, Mungo Lady has, but they are...
They're not silent, they're still there.
What should happen with them now?
Well, they'll work it out when they're ready to, them old people that are laying out there waiting.